On the day he died back in July 2004, Francis Crick, the guy who unlocked the structure of DNA, he was frantically editing a paper.
Right, and he wasn't writing about genetics.
Exactly. He was obsessed with this crumpled sheet of tissue hidden deep inside your head. It's actually like thinner than a standard credit card.
What?
And he firmly believed this tiny structure was the literal seat of human consciousness.
Such a remarkable historical detail, really. I mean, when a scientific mind of that caliber dedicates their final waking moments to a single, obscure brain region, it just signals that there is a profound mystery waiting to be unraveled.
And that mystery is the central mission of our deep dive today. We're pulling from this incredible article published in the OOTW Journal titled The Conductor in the Dark.
Which is a fantastic title, by the
It
way.
really is. So, okay, let's unpack this. We're looking at a structure called the claustrum.
Well, our goal isn't to, dumb down the science or patronize you by tiptoeing around the terminology because, well, you follow this space.
Right, you already know the brain is incredibly complex. Exactly. What we want to do is cut through the noise of conflicting clinical data to find the biological truth here. We want to understand how a massive storm of scattered neural signals inside your head actually becomes a unified self.
I mean, the main challenge with consciousness is that the brain processes our reality in totally disparate physical locations. Like the visual cortex in the back of your head processes the color of a passing car.
Right, while the auditory cortex on the side of your head processes the sound of its engine.
Exactly. And maybe the amygdala triggers a spike of fear if that car swerves too close. Yet you do not experience a chaotic, disjointed delay of sight, sound, and emotion. You experience one singular seamless moment.
Which is what neuroscientists call the binding problem. Like, how do we stitch all those separate sensory inputs together in time?
That is the big question.
So to understand why Crick thought the claustrum was the answer, the great stitcher, if you will, we really have to look at its extremely bizarre physical wiring.
Yeah, for over a century, the claustrum was largely ignored by researchers. It sits deep in the brain, buried under the insula, which is a region mostly responsible for mapping our internal bodily sensations.
And it doesn't look like a typical brain organ at all. Like, it doesn't have a chunky, distinct shape like the almond-shaped amygdala. It's just an incredibly slender, wavy sheet of gray matter.
Its shape actually made it notoriously difficult to study using traditional imaging. But the source material highlights this pivotal study from 2015 by Corinna Torgerson and her team that totally changed how we view this tissue.
Oh, yeah. They utilized advanced diffusion imaging on 100 human brains, right?
Yes, they did. And instead of just taking a static picture, diffusion imaging tracks the movement of water molecules along nerve fibers. This allows researchers to map the structural white matter highways of the brain.
And the results they found were just staggering. When Torgerson's team adjusted for its tiny volume, they discovered the claustrum has the highest connectivity of any structure in the entire human brain.
It is incredible.
It doesn't just talk to a few neighboring areas. It receives input from almost every single region of the cortex, and it projects neural signals back out to almost every single region of the cortex.
What's fascinating here is that the physical layout is perfectly optimized for a centralized hub. I mean, if you were engineering a system to synchronize independent processors, you would build a structure exactly like this.
That makes total sense.
You need a station that can instantly sample what the visual cortex is doing, sample what the auditory cortex is doing, and then broadcast a unifying rhythm back out to ensure they're operating on the exact same millisecond of reality.
So, in their 2005 posthumous paper, Crick and Christoph Koff hypothesized exactly this, calling the claustrum the brain's conductor.
Right.
Let's try to visualize how this actually functions. If the brain is a massive corporate office, the claustrum isn't the CEO making executive decisions. It's the central email server where every single department is BCC'd on every single message.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Right. The server ensures the visual department and the auditory department know they were looking at the exact same message at the exact same time. It's managing the massive flow of information to ensure the whole corporation acts as one cohesive entity.
The timestamping analogy captures the mechanism beautifully. The claustrum doesn't need to generate the content of your thoughts or the details of your vision. It simply provides the temporal binding.
It ensures the symphony plays in time.
Exactly. But, anatomical theory is only the first step in the scientific method. If this timestamp theory holds up, we should be able to see it fail when the system crashes.
Yeah, like if you suddenly tap the conductor's baton and halt the rhythm, what happens to the mind. That takes us into one of the most startling clinical observations in modern neuroscience.
The off-switch experiment.
Exactly. This comes from a 2014 study led by Mohamed Kubaisi involving a woman suffering from severe epilepsy.
To map her brain for a highly precise surgery, the medical team implanted depth electrodes deep inside her cranial cavity. This is just a standard procedure to find the origin point of seizures.
However, one of those electrodes happened to be positioned right next to her left claustrum.
Right, and when the doctors delivered high-frequency electrical stimulation through that specific electrode, the result was immediate.
The patient was sitting there reading a passage out loud, and she just stopped mid-action. She went completely blank, her breathing slowed down, she stared vacantly into space, and she became totally unresponsive to any visual or auditory commands from the doctors in the room.
Her conscious awareness essentially halted. And the critical distinction here is that this was not a seizure.
Wait, really?
Yeah, her brainwaves didn't show any epileptic activity during the stimulation.
Mm.
Nor was it a simple case of muscle paralysis where she was awake but unable to move. Every metric indicated she was entirely devoid of subjective experience.
And the moment they turned the electrical current off, she snapped right back into reality. She picked up the passage exactly where she had left off with absolutely zero memory of the blackout ever occurring.
It is wild. They could literally switch her off and switch her back on. On paper, it looked exactly like they found a light switch for human consciousness.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. I have to push back heavily on this conclusion because it feels a bit too convenient.
Fair enough.
Let me frame it this way. If I take a hammer and smash my kitchen radio, the music completely stops. But that doesn't mean the little musicians were living inside the radio. It just means I broke a crucial node in the transmission chain.
That is a great point.
Right. Does electrically disrupting this one tiny area actually prove that consciousness lives there, that it's generated inside the claustrum?
That is the exact critical lens the authors of the study and the article we are analyzing insist we apply. This raises an important question about how we define the source of awareness.
Because disrupting a system doesn't equal generating it.
Exactly. If you cut the power line to a house, the house goes dark, but the power line doesn't generate the electricity. Beyond the philosophy of the radio analogy, there are massive methodological caveats we have to consider here.
Starting with the most glaring issue. This is a sample size of exactly one.
Yes, N equals one is always a precarious foundation in neuroscience. We are talking about a single patient whose brain network had already been structurally and functionally altered by years of severe intractable epilepsy.
Furthermore, the brain is not a dry circuit board, it's wet tissue.
Right. When you apply high-frequency electrical stimulation, the current spreads. The electrode in this case was situated right on the border between the claustrum and the insula.
Meaning the blackout could have been the result of overwhelming the insula or shutting down a broader network entirely rather than a specific function of the claustrum itself.
Precisely. So attributing the total loss of consciousness solely to this one structure is heavily disputed. We have a tantalizing clinical clue, but with a giant asterisk attached.
So if electricity acts as a blunt hammer shutting the whole system down, it forces us to find more nuanced ways to investigate. Like, how do we observe what the structure does when it is actively working, just operating under different parameters?
Which opens up a completely different, yet incredibly revealing avenue of research. What happens if we chemically alter how the claustrum communicates with the rest of the brain?
Oh, this brings us into the realm of psychedelics.
Yes, it does. Yeah. The neuroanatomy here is fascinating because the claustrum isn't just densely connected with white matter highways. It is uniquely packed with specific chemical receptors.
It boasts one of the highest densities of serotonin 5-HT2A receptors of any subcortical structure in the brain, right?
Exactly. And for researchers studying altered states of consciousness, that specific alphanumeric string 5-HT2A is basically the holy grail.
Because that is the exact receptor targeted by classic psychedelics. Psilocybin, LSD, DMT, they all plug directly into the 5-HT2A receptor.
This biological reality led to a landmark 2020 study out of Johns Hopkins University, spearheaded by Frederick Barrett. The methodology here was elegant. They placed 15 participants in an fMRI scanner, administered psilocybin, and observed the real-time changes directly within the claustrum.
The fMRI scanner allows us to measure blood flow changes, which serve as a proxy for neural activity. And the Hopkins team observed two massive shifts, didn't they?
They did. First, the overall activity in the claustrum significantly dropped. The drug essentially downregulated the conductor. But more importantly, the drug rewired the network's connections on the fly.
Right. Under the influence of psilocybin, the colostrum actually uncoupled from the brain's auditory networks. And critically, it uncoupled from the default mode network.
The default mode network, or DMN, is an interconnected web of brain regions most heavily associated with our internal monologue, our autobiographical memory, and our core sense of self.
It's the network that is active when you are daydreaming or thinking about your past and future.
Exactly. And the Hopkins study found a direct correlation here. The size of the activity drop in the colostrum directly predicted the subjective intensity of the user's psychedelic trip.
Oh, wow. So the more the colostrum quieted down, the more intense and profound the experience was for the person inside the scanner?
Yes. It creates a fascinating phenomenological model. The colostrum's normal function, driven by its dense connectivity, seems to involve aggressively maintaining the boundaries of our conscious reality.
Okay, so what does this all mean?
Well, it keeps the auditory signals distinct from the visual signals, and it keeps the internal narrative of the default mode network separate from the external sensory world.
So if the colostrum is normally the conductor tightly binding all our senses and memories into a neat, bounded little package we call the ego, does psilocybin essentially slip the conductor a blindfold?
That's a brilliant way to look at it.
Because without that strict temporal management, the boundaries between the senses and the boundaries between the self and the outside world, they just melt into each other.
You are describing the neurological basis of ego dissolution. This is the hallmark of a deep psychedelic experience, the profound, sometimes terrifying feeling where the borders of your identity soften and you feel a sense of unity with everything around you. Mm. If we connect this to the bigger picture, if quieting the colostrum correlates with dissolving the ego, it strongly supports the theory that the colostrum is fundamentally involved in constructing that ego in the first place.
However, we have to look at the limitations of fMRI technology. The scanner measures the BOLD-D signal, the blood oxygen level dependent imaging.
Right. It is tracking blood flow.
Which is a proxy for neural activity, sure, but it is not a direct measure of neurons actually firing.
The golden rule of science remains, correlation does not equal causation. The Hopkins study proves that psilocybin alters the colostrum's connectivity, and that this alteration tracks tightly with the subjective intensity of ego dissolution.
But it does not definitively prove that the colostrum generates the ego all by itself.
Exactly. It is a phenomenally motivated hypothesis, mm-hmm. but we cannot leap to definitive causation based purely on blood flow imaging.
Which brings us to the most crucial part of our investigation. The seduction of a simple answer is powerful. It's so tempting to look at the massive physical connectivity, the off switch in the epilepsy patient, and the psychedelic ego-death correlation, and just crown the colostrum as the magical seat of the soul.
It is tempting. But when we look at traumatic injury in animal models, the neat little narrative begins to fall apart. Examining the counter-evidence is vital because the clinical data presents serious hurdles for the seat of consciousness theory.
Yeah, because if the colostrum is the single flame that keeps the lights of awareness on, the biological logic demands that destroying it would extinguish the light permanently.
Precisely. A 2015 study by Chow and colleagues tested this exact grim reality. They analyzed data from 171 combat veterans who had survived penetrating traumatic brain injuries.
We are talking about severe shrapnel wounds to the head, and some of these veterans had sustained direct physical destruction of their colostrum.
If the theory holds, localized destruction of the consciousness generator should result in a permanent vegetative state.
But that isn't what the data showed at all. The study found that damage to the colostrum did impact the duration of the consciousness they lost immediately following the injury.
Right. They might have been unconscious longer than patients with damage to other areas.
But these veterans were not left permanently unconscious. They woke up. They recovered conscious function.
You simply cannot destroy the engine block and expect the car to start. The survivability of colostrum destruction strongly indicates that consciousness is a widely distributed phenomenon across the cortex, not something generated in one tiny room.
When we shift to animal models, researchers have been able to get incredibly precise. Using optogenetics and targeted neuronal manipulation in mice, they can stimulate or silence the colostrum neuron by neuron.
And the results here paint a radically different picture than a mystical soul organ. A 2018 study by Atlan revealed that in mice, the colostrum operates as an attentional filter. It helps the animal ignore irrelevant distractions in its environment.
And following that, a 2018 study by Jackson demonstrated that the colostrum actually delivers massive inhibitory signals to the prefrontal cortex, effectively reining in higher-level processing rather than sparking it.
Yes. And perhaps the most damning evidence against the consciousness generator theory comes from a 2020 study by Noricchio.
What'd they find?
They showed that actively stimulating the colostrum doesn't wake the brain up or spark vivid awareness.
Yeah.
It actually plunges the entire cortex into synchronized slow-wave downstates. It forces the brain into the deep unconscious rhythms of sleep.
Wow. So plunging the cortex into a slow-wave downstate is an inhibitory action. It is the colostrum acting as a silencer, sweeping across the brain to quiet the noise.
Exactly.
Hold on. So instead of a magical consciousness generator, it actually sounds more like a highly aggressive spam filter for our attention, like a master volume knob.
That is a spot-on realization. The demystification of the colostrum is, in many ways, more incredible than the myth. We don't need it to be a magical organ for it to be profoundly important.
It suppresses the chaotic noise of the brain so we can actually focus on one thing at a time.
Yes. The cumulative evidence suggests the colostrum is the critical machinery that shapes, steadies, and filters our reality. It manages salience. It tells the vast, distributed network of the brain what matters right now and what to ignore.
It coordinates the rhythm of the cortex not by generating the music, but by silencing the discordant notes.
Precisely.
Let's trace the arc of what we've unpacked today, because it is a masterclass in how scientific understanding evolves. We started with Francis Crick's dying obsession, convinced this tissue paper thin structure held the ultimate key to the mind.
We looked at its unrivaled structural connectivity, wired into every corner of the brain like a centralized time stamping server.
We analyzed the startling off-switch anomaly in the Kubici epilepsy study and carefully disentangled the act of disrupting a circuit from the act of generating awareness.
Right, and then we explored the dense concentration of 5-HT2A receptors and how psilocybin chemically blindfolds this network hub, uncoupling it from the default mode network and potentially triggering the dissolution of the ego.
And finally, we confronted the sobering reality of the combat veteran data and the mouse models,
which revealed that rather than being the solitary seat of the soul, the colostrum is the brain's ultimate editor. It is the inhibitory broadcaster that filters the chaos into a coherent, navigable reality.
It is hiding in the dark, constantly editing the symphony of your life. As you process the words we are speaking right now, as you filter out the background noise of your room, that microscopic sheet of tissue inside your own head is firing.
It is suppressing the irrelevant distractions so you can focus on this specific moment in time. It is a remarkable piece of biological engineering working furiously to maintain the boundaries of your experience.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final unscripted thought to chew on, something that stretches beyond the biological data we've covered today.
Okay, let's hear it.
If our unified sense of self, our very ability to filter out the noise and feel like a cohesive entity, relies on a physical biological bottleneck like the colostrum. If it relies on that bottleneck, could an artificial intelligence ever truly become conscious without an equivalent localized physical bottleneck of its own?
Oh, wow.
Or is the colostrum biological proof that true consciousness actually requires physical limits and constraints to bind the infinite processing power of a brain?
The necessity of a physical bottleneck for artificial consciousness is a phenomenal question. I mean, if boundless processing lacks a centralized editor to filter the noise, it may never achieve a unified perspective.
It is certainly something to ponder the next time you marvel at how seamless the world feels and realize how much active filtering it takes just to experience a single moment. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the OOTW Journal's fascinating research.
Keep applying that critical lens to your world, and we will catch you next time.
Stay curious, everyone.